Hi, my name is Carrie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Carrie. We love you, Carrie. Lots and lots and lots. And all of this.
Well, thanks. Well, the first thing that I want to say is that my sponsor tells me that the more I speak and the longer I'm sober and the more I do this, the easier it gets. That's the only thing that my sponsor has told me that's just not true. I hate speaking. Half the time I black out. I have no idea what I say. People are like, oh, good share. I like when you said this. And I'm thinking, oh, shit. What else did I say, you know? I don't want to spend too much time on the war stories. If you guys are here, you know what it's like out there. It's not fun. But I will touch on that because I do need to qualify. I was one of those kids that grew up watching my older brother in and out of rehab, getting arrested, you know, doing whatever, joyriding at 14, you know, and I was never going to be like him, never. Later, he became my drug dealer, and I was his middleman, and we had a beautiful relationship. Alcohol was my solution when I started drinking. My first suicide attempt was before I ever drank. When I found alcohol, I found relief. And that's awesome, you know? And it lasted as long as it did until it stopped working. When I got here, I had a really hard time with the alcoholic part. When I was a kid, my parents used to take me into New York City, and we would drive around, and you know, we would see like the guys in the gutter with the brown paper bags drinking, and they were old, and that was an alcoholic. You know, that's, you had to be male, you had to be old, and you had to be homeless. You know, that's what an alcoholic looked like to me. I had no idea that that's really not the case. You know. We all look very different, but what's the same is that we suffer from the same disease. And again, the details may be different. You know, I would get caught up when I got here on the details. You know, I wasn't old enough. Well, I was barely old enough to drive when I got here, and nobody thought that it was a good idea that I get my license until I had about 3 years sober. And even that was a little iffy. When I got here, people used to call me a fucked case. My brain just didn't work, you know, and I just didn't get it. And part of the reason why I think I didn't get it was because the people that I ran with, like, when you guys taught me about the physical craving, right, that like craving where you have a drink and then you need more, it didn't make sense to me because I just thought that that's how it was. You know, that's what everybody experienced. Everybody woke up and needed a drink, you know. And that's most of the people that I hung with, like that's how it worked, you know. But what I didn't get was that that's not everybody. You know, my parents don't wake up and need a drink. There's a lot of people I know that don't wake up and need a drink. I just didn't get it. You know, I didn't get the mental obsession part because, I thought that that's just how it was. That's how everybody is, you know. And since I'm not old, male, and homeless, like, obviously I don't have a problem, you know. I also didn't understand binge drinking when I got here. I was always loaded, you know. alcohol wasn't my only thing. I did a lot of drugs, and I did them alcoholically. I was always loaded. I blacked out a lot. I would come to you sometimes covered in scrapes and bruises with twigs and leaves stuck in my hair, and, you know, and I would have no idea what would happen, you know. I had no idea. And my friends and I always had a don't ask, don't tell policy. You know, it was always better just not knowing, you know? Basically what happened was it stopped working. It just simply stopped working. When I was 15, I got busted again. And I was fortunate enough to have very loving parents who pushed me into counseling. And I was really fortunate enough to get a counselor who happened to be an alcoholic who got sober at the age of 15. So for me, like, there was no excuse. Being young was not an excuse. It did not work. And she was an amazing lady who really helped me to understand what was happening. But the bottom line is I was just hurt bad enough, you know. We hear it all the time. I couldn't die and I couldn't live, you know, and I was stuck. And I didn't think that my solution was getting sober, because that just seemed like an insane, ridiculous solution to me. But I couldn't do what I was doing anymore. And I saw some people who seemed to be pretty happy, you know, and they could go to school and they could go to work. And some of them had cars and driver's license, and their parents didn't try to drug test them, you know, and they didn't have drug sniffing dogs in the house, you know what I mean? And I didn't know what that was like. I didn't get sober because I wanted to be sober. I got sober because I just wanted to be okay for 5 minutes. You know, I didn't get sober to make a lifelong commitment to this beautiful spiritual way of life. I just didn't know what else to do, you know. So I see a lot of newcomers come in, and they're excited, and they're like, yeah, I'm sober, and this is awesome, and they can walk in a straight line and tie their shoes and form complete sentences. That is not my experience. It took me about 2.5 months to learn how to tie my shoes again. You know, my brain was just so fried, I couldn't do it, you know. My emotions would come out in very inappropriate ways at inappropriate times. You know, a good song would come on the radio and I'm like in the car bawling. Or, you know, somebody would say something funny and I'm like screaming and cursing at them. Like, it just didn't... I just couldn't function for a while, but I had some amazingly patient people that hung out with me and taught me how to live. I got sober at 16 years old. My sobriety date is January 1st, 96. I didn't do that on purpose. But what I really want to talk about is the program. And if you guys don't know what the program is, there's some books that we have here that are blue. Pick one up, read it. That's the program. That's our basic text. That's how we learn how to live. And I need that. You know, I need that. I know that I can stay sober, you know, but I don't know how to live. And that's what teaches me, you know. Because I know that if I live out of those defects and I live out of self-will and I'm miserable and I'm resentful and I'm living out of fear, I can't stay sober like that forever, you know? So I worked the steps a couple of times with some different sponsors, and after a period of time I was still miserable and I wanted to drink, and I was crazy, and I didn't know why. And I picked up the big book, and I started reading it, and I started realizing that the steps that I was working were not out of the big book. I don't know where they were from, but it was not really the clear-cut directions that were given. And I was dying inside, you know, and I had a sponsor who I would call up and freak out to, and she would say, take a bubble bath, I'm not really a bubble bath kind of person, so, you know, and I really don't think that's going to keep me sober. So there was one person that I knew of that knew what the book said, And at 3 years sober, my life is falling apart, and I just left my abusive boyfriend, and I had a gun, and I was going to kill people, and the gun was broken, and it gets crazier from there, you know, and I'm sober. Like, that's no way to live, you know? And so, you know, there's this dude that I knew who worked a program, you know, and knew what the book said, so I asked him to sponsor me. And I've had a male sponsor for most of my sobriety. And because of him, I know what the book says. You know what I mean? And not just that, but I know how to apply it into my daily life. Not that I'm perfect at it. I definitely don't claim that. But I'm good. You know what I mean? I haven't wanted to drink in a really long time. You know? And when I'm actively working the steps and I'm really living in those steps, which is kind of difficult at first, you know, but it gets easier. I'm okay, you know, I'm okay. And I can lay in bed at night and fall asleep and my head shuts up, you know. And I don't want to drink and I don't want to kill myself and life is good, you know. I have a higher power, which I don't really understand, you know. All I need to know is that there's a power greater than myself, and it's not me, and I'm good with that, you know. I'm really good with that, and some days I have to keep it that simple, and every morning I do the third step, and I do the seventh step, and I try to do my 11th step prayer, but that's like a really difficult one for me to do. I've been really good at it lately. but it's the easiest one for me to slack on, you know, and I feel it when I slack on it. And I just got to live in those steps, you know, and I do 10 steps all throughout the day. And I've been doing it for so long that it's just kind of automatic to me now, you know. And when I call my sponsor, I already know my part. You know, I don't have to, like, argue with him over what is and is not my part anymore, you know. And I get to make amends quickly, and most of the time I don't have to make amends because I've learned restraint of tongue and pen, you know. And life isn't perfect, and life isn't always good, you know, and life happens. I just want to tell a really quick story, and then I'm going to pass, but one of my amends was to my grandmother, who my grandmother was just kind of an all-around badass. You know, born and raised in New York City, Irish Catholic New Yorker. She would go out partying, you know. She never baked cookies or pies or anything like that. She was just hardcore, you know. And I always kind of wanted to be that hardcore, you know. She would go out clubbing at 75. That's just cool, you know. And I owed my grandmother an amends. And I flew out to New York to make the amends. And, you know, I sat down with her and I'm like, Grandma, I really got to talk to you about something. And she's like, what's up? And I'm like, you know, I owe you an amends. And she looked at me and she said, what are you talking about? You can't do anything wrong. You don't owe an amends. And I'm like, okay. And I tried to make an amends to her three times because I'm persistent. And after the third time, my sponsor's like, just stop. Just stop. You know, maybe to make an amends would harm her. And maybe that's why she's saying that. Just don't do it. So I never got to say, Grandma, I was wrong. And it kind of wore on me, but a few years back, my grandmother got sick. And we flew her out here, or out to Phoenix, and she moved in with us, and I got to help take care of her, right? Which was probably one of the hardest things I ever had to do in my life. And I watched her die of cancer. And that was like me getting to right those wrongs because I was never there. You know, I never showed up. And when I did show up, I was usually detoxing and miserable, you know, and angry. And I got to step up to the plate and really be there for my grandmother, you know. And a few months after she passed away, it hit me that not once did I think about stealing her medication. Not once did I even realize that there was medication. And that's God working in my life, you know? That's my higher power right there. And I don't know, that's just one of the cool things that we get to experience in the program. So if you're new or if you're not new, because sometimes when we're not new, we forget, get a sponsor who knows what the book says. Read the book with other people who know what the book says. Don't try to figure it out on your own. Work the steps. Find a power greater than yourself and just do the deal, and we get to stay sober. And that's it. Thanks, guys.
Okay, guys, please help me welcome our main speaker tonight, Andrew M. from Denver, Colorado.
That's what I'm talking about. Good evening, family. My name's Andrew. I'm an alcoholic.
Andrew, we love you.
Wonderful, I love you too. thank you guys so much for being here. I really enjoy participating in these experiences with all sorts of young people that are just crazy and psychotic and dressed up like, you know, frogs and bumblebees dancing on chairs for 15 minutes. And, you know, I just love you guys, man. You're all wonderful. This is a really cool experience for me, and to be able to have this opportunity to be invited to share my experience with you all is a very unique, very humbling, very, very powerful experience. If you get the opportunity, if somebody ever asks you to tell your story, don't hesitate, just say yes. You'll be absolutely pissed off and freaked out all the way up until you're done with it. But it's a really cool experience. And I remember the first time I spoke, I went to the guy who had originally 12-stepped me, and he had asked me to speak at this treatment center that I was kicked out of. Once he heard I actually stayed sober for a year, he said, "Oh man, we got to get you to come back and tell us what you actually did." Then I went back there, and afterwards I was like, "Man, I don't know what I said." You know, the same types of things Carrie was talking about. He said, "There's always three talks. There's the one that you wanted to give, there's the one that you would have given, and there's the one that you gave." And it's always stuck with me. You know, he said, basically to me what that means is if I invite this power that has given me this experience, this awakening, into this journey with you guys, then the one that I give is going to be the one that I'm supposed to give, and I just get to kind of participate in that process. So I don't write it down and take notes and come in prepared. I just kind of go with the flow. And that's why I just love this sobriety countdown stuff, and everybody's freaking out and all the energy, and I get connected to you guys through that. I get to feel that connection. Like, I know where you guys are at right now. You're excited to be here. You're excited to have fun and be sober. That's cool. And then there's a bunch of people who need to go and pee and run because they've been around here for like an hour, so I won't be upset if you need to. I get it. But I'm just really happy to be here with you guys this weekend. Thank you to the host committee as well. It's a lot of work to put one of these things on. Can we give a round of applause to the host committee? As my good friend Lindsay said last night, you know, if you really want to learn about your character defects, get onto a committee with a bunch of your friends and try to put on an event. You know, you will figure out exactly where your character flaws are very quickly, or you'll just get drunk. you know, I want to give one other shout out too. There's a guy in this room who I met when I got here. He's like one of the first people I met in the hallway, and he was actually drunk here last year when it was in Tucson. And he's going to have a year in a couple of days. So, Lawrence, man, isn't it Lawrence, right? Take some guts to walk back after an experience like that. So, And they're like a shooting and all kinds of stuff. Man, you Arizona people are crazy. I love it. I'm right at home with you sick bastards. This is cool. This is really cool. So I drank alcohol. It was fun, and then it really started to suck. And then I started trying to make it be fun again, and that sucked. And then once it sucked enough, I got sober. So now let's talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you thought I was joking. Program of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And what I get this opportunity to do right now is called 12-step work. I get to sit here and I get to share my experiences with you in a way that hopefully will help you identify and say, you know what? Yeah, I felt like that. I thought like that. Yeah, maybe I drank like that guy, but more importantly, maybe this program can work for me too. And that's the joy of the 12-step, right? This love with no need for anything to be paid back to me. The only thing that I'm here to do is to offer you the same love that was offered to me by sharing with myself everything I have of myself to you openly, expecting nothing in return. The only thing I know that'll happen is if I stay here and I share my experience with you for this next hour is I'll be sober. And hopefully one person in this room will hear something. It'll impact your heart. It will change your experience and your journey. And then you'll get to come here and walk with us in this journey of Alcoholics Anonymous and find recovery. That's the gift that I hope to share with you guys tonight. And that's the gift that was given to me through Alcoholics Anonymous, is the power to help others. You know, because lack of power is my dilemma. I had to find a power by which I could live. And as it was pointed out to me, that power is outlined right there in the book. It says, why shouldn't we laugh? We talk about these experiences, where we came from. We laugh. We say, oh, yeah, I was a sick, crazy bastard too. Yeah, ha, 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 ha. You know, and outsiders look at us and go, what the hell is wrong with you people? That's actually not funny. but why shouldn't we laugh? We've recovered, and we've been given the power to help others. Right? And that's the power that was given to me through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, is the power to help others. I have that. I have that now. So thank you, Eddie, for inviting me to be here to share that with you guys through my experience. I did drink alcohol. It was fun. It was exciting in the beginning. I mean, Bill talks about that, right? That's his 12-step call to us, is that he left for us in the pages of the Big Book. It's his story. And he talks about how when he first started drinking, the excitement, right, that he found in those moments of war, you know, and coming home, and the intervals hilarious, right? Like he found liquor and he found the excitement, and almost immediately after he found that he was kind of lonely. He felt weird, kind of off, and he again turned to alcohol. And that was my experience too, you know. I started drinking because I had a bunch of older friends that played in death metal bands, and their brothers played in bands and drank alcohol and liked to smash bottles on each other's heads, and I thought they were cool. And so somebody said something about, you know, they drank like a tequila sunrise while they were like writing a paper. I don't know. So I broke into my parents' liquor cabinet. I didn't even know what the hell that was, and I found the coolest looking bottle of alcohol that I could find, and it was this teardrop shaped burgundy colored bottle that said triple orange brandy. Yeah. For those of you guys that went, ugh, that's identification. That stuff should not exist on the planet. Much less be drank or drank by itself. I don't know what the hell is supposed to happen with it. I drank it that one night and never saw it again, thank God. But I grabbed that bottle because I'm 11. It's just cool looking. And I go back to my room. I got this piece of crap waterbed, and I just kind of sit down on the waterbed. And I start choking this stuff down, and it's just disgusting. It's just burning the hell out of my throat. I'm choking it down. It's thick, and it's got this nasty flavor to it. It's like I'm just drinking horrible cough syrup, sucking this stuff down, and all of a sudden I was very comfortable there. I had no interest in leaving that waterbed. Until the waterbed seemed to start moving on its own. I wasn't moving. I had sunk all the way down into the corner between the wall and the water mattress, just looking at my blacklight poster on the ceiling. You know? And all of a sudden I ran fire hose vomiting down the hallway. And my black belt codependent mother cleaned all that up, and we never even had a conversation about it. That was my first experience with alcohol. I don't know that that was an allergy or that I was drinking more because I couldn't control it. I just kept drinking really fast, really disgusting crap. And once it all hit my stomach, I got real, real drunk, real, real fast, and then threw up, you know. And the next day, for some reason, I wanted to do it again. Not with that stuff. But I did like the feeling that it produced kind of right at the beginning, right when the warm, fuzzy thing started, where it had gone past my throat and it got into my chest and it started burning, and that burn just kind of moved up and over the top of my head and down the rest of my body into my toes, and that's when I got really comfortable in that waterbed. That was what I wanted, right there. And if I could do that with a different kind of alcohol, I would do that. It's hot up here, I'm sorry, I'm going to take this off. Nice. Just stop there, is that what you said, Eddie? So, like I said, it was exciting. Like, before this, I had been like that kid, okay? Like, I woke up at 4:30 in the morning when I was in fifth grade, and I ate cereal and got a flashlight and walked to school, and, you know, I was that kid. I did all my schoolwork before school started. My teacher brought me donuts because she knew I was coming. I loved that I beat her to school every day. I mean, I was that guy. And the summer between fifth and sixth grade, right, was when everything changed. I had started drinking, and then I started smoking cigarettes all the time, and I was like, oh, you know, I'm going to ditch class and be like the cool kid and go play music and do all this stuff. I was going to be a rock star, and that became really exciting to me. I decided that the music business must be it. This is what's happening, right? Because these guys in the music business that I was listening to music and enjoying, they all got loaded. They seemed to be doing just fine. Later, Kurt Cobain would make my resentment inventory because he did not do just fine. And he was one of my heroes, you know? It was like, everything's falling apart. But I really thought that that was exciting, and so I aspired, kind of like Bill when he talks in his story about becoming a lawyer, going to law school. He saw that law school was, you know, one way where he could make a bunch of money and be around these people, but then he got into Wall Street. And Wall Street to him was this inviting maelstrom, right, which is a turbulent, irresistible force or a whirlpool. So what happened for me is I started going to all these different shows and little underground rave parties where you got to like go over here and buy a bag of Skittles and then bring it to this dude in a white van, and he gives you the ticket for $5, and then you show up and they make sure you're not a cop, and then you go and, you know, and I was like, dude, this is it, you know, I am in. I'm 13, I'm crazy, you know, I'm drinking and doing all kinds of other non-AA stuff and just losing my mind, you know, invited into this turbulent, irresistible force. And at that time, you know, Bill, his heroes were big financial leaders and all these guys on Wall Street that had lots of money and wore suits. And for me, it was the guys that were in the background. They were running the scene. They seemed to have power. They had that thing, right? That thing about them where when they walked in the room, like, they controlled the room. And what that thing was is it was fear, because these guys, they carried guns and they ran the scene behind this thing. And I was like, man, that's what I want. I want to be those guys. And so I worked very hard at that. I didn't do very well. I carried guns and I did a lot of really stupid stuff and I was incredibly violent. But the problem was is I didn't identify with that person, right? Like, I wanted to be this guy. I wanted to be a tough guy. I wanted to be scary. I wanted what I thought was on the outside of what these guys were doing. I wanted what it looked like. But once I was there and I slept with an SKS machine gun under my mattress and was, like, totally psychotic, like, waiting for them to come with tinfoil over the windows, like, you know, didn't see the sun for, like, 4 months type stuff, you know, like, just waiting for them to come through the door. I realized I really didn't want to be there, you know? It sucked. And so, of course, I became a serious drinker, drinking all day and almost every night. As Bill talked about, I drank a lot of honey brown beer. And I had this commercial, Bow Down to the Tiki God. So I wrote, like, Bow Down to the Tiki God in honey brown beer bottle cap stuck into the ceiling in my crappy apartment, you know. And, like, 300 beer bottle caps. There's no problem yet, though. You know, things got kind of scary. A bunch of my friends started getting killed. You know, the violence was kind of out of control, and so I decided that obviously Denver, Colorado, where I'm from, is the problem because it's very dangerous here, and so I just need to leave. So I'm going to go to San Francisco because obviously there's no drugs or alcohol or scary people in San Francisco. So that's going to work out. I'm going to run from my problems to the beach. And, you know, what really sucks about that is that I went to California, I got arrested, I went to jail, I was homeless, I was living on the street, I was living in the park, I was running these little crews, just running little scams and doing my thing. And, you know, liquor had ceased to become a luxury, it had become a necessity, and I didn't recognize this. I'm drinking in the park with, like, you know, the people that qualified for Carrie's description of alcoholic, old, homeless, and psychotic looking with brown bags. You know, I'm drinking with these old homeless guys in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco and hanging out with these gutter punk kids and jumping people for no reason and robbing them and just doing scary stuff. Living in a bush and thinking I've got it all under control. And the reason I say that I think I had it all under control is I actually thought that this was what I wanted to do. I thought that I just wanted to be an alcoholic. And I just wanted to live this life, like, kind of on the skids and be the tough guy and be the, you know, do all this scary stuff because it was part of, like, my rep or something. You know, I'd already been to treatment a few times by the time I was in California at age 19. I'd been in 3 different treatment programs and spent almost a year of my life in jail. And, you know, I'm talking, like, treatment programs where they put you out in the middle of Utah and they shave your head and scream in your face, and by the end of it you're, like, taking care of a horse and going down and helping the people around the church and stuff. You know? And I mean, I felt good. I'd like put on some weight. I'm like, yeah, man, I'm throwing hay bales around, like, just loving this stuff. You know, I can't wait to get home and hang out with my friends because it's important. And every time I went to a treatment like that, I got out and I got loaded, you know. So I'd already done all that stuff and passed it and still thought I had it under control because I thought, like, this is what I wanted to do. I need to be with my people, right? I need to do these things that fit into this schema of who I thought I was. I just thought I was an alcoholic, and I didn't know what that was. I just thought, like, it was just this thing that I had chosen to be. And then I went to jail in California, and what happened was is I was looking at prison time, and they picked me up. I was in this place, San Bruno. It's south of San Francisco County Jail. It's a big, tall, wonderful, beautiful jail that was built in the early 1900s. They put a bunch of Japanese in there after Pearl Harbor and just tortured them and all kinds of scary stuff. You can just feel the scary crap going on in that building when you went in there. 6 floors. I'm on the bottom with these 2 tiers with 50 bunk beds, 100 guys, all felons, just crazy. 19. Sitting here looking at my life going, okay, how did I get here? I was that kid that walked to school at 4:30 in the morning and did all my classwork and ate donuts and helped the other kids all day. How did I get here? Now I'm about to go to San Quentin, you know? And so I grabbed the Bible. Nobody else thought that was funny. That's weird. did I mention I'm not religious? But I grabbed the first thing toward God I could think of. And I grabbed it, and I'm reading it. God, do you see me reading this? And his sons lived for this many 100 years. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm reading that chapter too, okay? I'm reading this whole thing. Please get me out of here sane and alive, because I swear if you get me out of here, I will never, ever drink again. And I meant it. I absolutely meant it. And they took me to court, and I was going to be sentenced that day. And they drove me from San Bruno to San Francisco, and they said America's been attacked. These planes were headed on their way to San Francisco. They were fueled up, and they turn around, and they hit these buildings in New York. And in my narcissistic little mind, I thought that meant that we were going to be released because they were evacuating the building. And I said, God, thank you, you know. Answered my prayer. Until everybody left except for us, which you don't want to put a bunch of violent felons in a jail cell and tell them that at any moment the building next door is this big financial target that could be, like, assaulted by a plane and blow up and kill all of you and you guys can just die and then leave. That's, like, a really bad idea. It does not bode well with the inmates who then are running the asylum. You know, so it turned into this big old crazy thing. Everybody's doing all their fun stuff in cups and throwing it at the doors and lighting stuff on fire and beating each other up. And I just kind of huddled over by the little steel toilet going, how do you like this now, tough guy? You know, you wanted to be the tough guy. Here you are. What are you going to do? And I actually did not go to prison. and was taken back to San Bruno, sat in that jail where they controlled the TVs, watched plane hitting tower, 15 hours a day. Called my mom, because that's what I did. It was right around her birthday, so I always called her either when there was like a international crisis or it was her birthday or mine to ask for money. Called her, and she told me she had been in like the World Trade Center like a few days before, eating on the top floor or something, and I was like, wow, crazy, Mom. Well, can you help me get out of jail? Because I'm about to go to prison, you know? I realized you were, you know. And she didn't help me. And I said, okay, whatever. And I went to my sentencing, and they actually dropped the charges down because there were so many violent crimes going on, race crimes going on in San Francisco at the time, that they just said, we're going to kick you out of the city for 3 years and just don't come back. That's bad. You go to a city to try to escape from your problems, and the end result is they kick you out of the city. Say, you can't come back to San Francisco, of all places. I mean, they accept anybody, right, Lindsay? I love you. And anyway, I just kept running away from all my problems, traveling around the country, went to Seattle, you know, and there's obviously drugs and alcohol in Seattle, you know, traveled. I went all over North America, and, you know, it had ceased to be a luxury, it had become a necessity, and as, you know, I was released from that jail, what happened was, is immediately when I knew I was getting out, I went straight down to Haight Street where I knew I could buy a blueberry bomber for, you know, $2. It's like, well, I'm just going to get this little bomber here and it's going to be all right. What happened? I knew my life was headed down this path. I'm going to prison. I'm going, God, get me out of this sane alive. I'll never ever drink again. But obviously this didn't have anything to do with God. It was because these planes hit the towers. So he didn't help me. So I guess I'm just, I mean, none of that stuff crossed my mind. It was just, I knew I was getting out and boom, liquor store. I know where it is. They'll sell to me when I'm 19. Sweet, that's where I'm going. I ended up in jail in Seattle like 9 months later, looking back at it, realizing for the first time that it was out of control. And Bill talks about that. You know, he talks about setting up this business deal with his friends, and you know, he goes out to hang out with them, and they're drinking, but he's not drinking. He's not going to drink, right? And what happened was, is he had this business deal the next morning, and they're passing around this bottle of Applejack, and it comes to him, and they say, you know, you want to hit this Applejack? He says, no, I'm not drinking. Are you sure? It's a fine bottle of Applejack. He says, I got this business thing tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? And by the time that bottle went all the way back around, he decided, you know, I've never actually tried Applejack. So I should at least try it and see what it tastes like. And he drank. And, you know, he drank and didn't show up for that business deal the next morning. And he woke up and saw for the first time, I cannot take so much as one drink. That was my experience after getting out of jail in San Francisco and just having one drink without a second thought and ending up in jail in another city in the same damn situation like 9 months later. I looked back. I was actually for the first time getting that moment of clarity and realizing I wasn't in control. This had nothing to do with me controlling my situation. This was absolutely lost. And you know, I still drank for a few more years. I came back. I went back to Colorado. I connected with my father, who I hadn't spoken with for 6 years. And he helped me get into a treatment center. And this guy in the treatment center, the guy I referred to earlier, the one who originally 12-stepped me, kind of, you know, neatly suggested I might want to go to some AA meetings after he told me his story. He had 32 years sober. And I went to an AA meeting. I went to a closed AA meeting, and I talked about the drugs I'd been doing. And I had somebody tell me, actually cut me off in the middle of my share and tell me to keep that junkie shit to myself, at which point I stopped and immediately said to myself, I don't belong here with you guys. I don't fit in. But I stayed for the rest of the meeting. And before I went home to drink the 2 6-packs that I had at home by myself, I sat outside that meeting smoking cigarettes. And everybody looked at this 19-year-old psychotic homeless kid that was showing up to this meeting with a bunch of people that were a lot older and were in this closed meeting. They looked at me. I had dreadlocks down, you know, a little past my cheeks. I was probably about 135, 140 pounds. I'm like 180 right now. And they looked at me with fear. The same fear that I had wanted to have before, where I walked into a room and people would be afraid of me so that I could control what was going on. I had that in Alcoholics Anonymous. It worked, and not one person came up and talked to me. I had 2 heart attacks and a stroke before I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a few years later. Not one of them came up and wanted to talk to me about my drinking, which at the time, like I said, I was buying 1 or 2 6-packs of Henry Weinhardt's Private Reserve because I drank it because my friend drank it up until he was murdered, you know. So I had to at least drink to him while I'm getting sober. Nobody came to talk to me about that, figure out if I was alcoholic and if I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. They heard the scary stuff that I used to control environments, and it worked here. Which is why I don't talk about all the really scary stuff much anymore, unless you want to talk to me after the meeting. So I spent the last few years of my drinking homeless in Denver, Colorado, playing my guitar on a pedestrian mall in downtown, just lost. I was tired of robbing people. I was tired of coming up with different hustles. I kind of run out of everything, so I just waited for people to come off of the Greyhound bus and stop in Denver for about 30 minutes. If anybody ever did that and got robbed by a weird hippie kid, it was probably me. I'm sorry. I just did that and panhandled. I was wrong. If there's anything I can do to make it right, come talk to me after the meeting. And then I got this guy who walked up to me one day, and he'd been coming up. He was an outreach worker, and he was not one of us. And he'd been coming up, and he'd hand me a pair of clean socks and just talk to me and have a conversation. And this guy said that he'd move me into my own apartment if I could stay sober for a week. And 2 years later, I got moved in there because they knew I was going to die on the street. I got out of a hospital after this guy like beat me half to death, went over to grab his gun and shoot me, and I had called my mother, which every tough guy does, and I called this guy just to let him know what was going on, and he said, "Man, we'll move you in. Let me just see if I can find an open apartment." And they moved me into this housing program for street kids, and when I went there, people were going to meetings, and I started going to meetings. I didn't really have anything else to do. I was going, and I put my hood up in the back of the room, and I put my tough guy face on, and if I did talk, I talked about really cool spiritual stuff or how scary I was, all that kind of crap, and and then I saw this guy, and he had long hair, and I saw him at like a concert, and so I was like, "Oh my God, it's a sign," because I was going to drink, and then I saw him. I was like, "Oh shit, I can't drink if the guy I'm going to ask to sponsor me is here." So I went and hung out with him, asked him to sponsor me, got a girlfriend because she was in the treatment program down the street, so obviously that was meant to be. And then she drank, was vomiting blood and jumping out of my moving vehicle, so I had to break up with her because, it's just best for my sobriety that I'm single. And then she slept with my sponsor to get back at me, which, for you new people in the room, I would suggest that you look for a sponsor who you want what they have. Because he was willing to go to any lengths for what I had, and that was not working out for me. So, so unfortunately, what happened after that is I got a friend as a sponsor, and I wasn't really serious about it, and I was going to meetings, and I woke up one day, I had about 5.5 months sober. I'd had a heart attack in January of 2005, and that kept me sober, fear and that and all that crazy stuff for about 5.5 months. And I woke up one day, and I wanted to get drunk. And what happens when an alcoholic like me wants to get drunk and I don't have a spiritual solution in my life is I get drunk. Even though I know it's a bad idea. Lindsay was talking about that last night. I absolutely 100% identify with that. The mental obsession for alcoholism is not defined as when I stop, I can't stop thinking about it. For 5.5 months, I didn't really think about alcohol. I thought about myself, my crazy psychotic girlfriend, and all sorts of really stupid crap. I wasn't thinking about drinking. But as soon as the thought did come in, it crowded out all others. That's the definition of obsession, right? Is the thought that crowds out all others. The thought or feeling that outweighs all others. And as soon as the thought to drink entered into my mind, it outweighed everything else. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I'd had a heart attack 5.5 months before at 21 years old. I had a minor stroke 6 months before that. I was walking across the street and my whole one half of my body froze up. I went and got on the bus and went to the hotel and got loaded. I knew what was going to happen if I drank again. I knew it. But once that thought came in, it didn't matter. I got in my car because I'd gotten a job with that car and that girlfriend and all this other stuff. And I had it together. I got in my car and I'm driving and I'm turning the car knowing if this car ends at its destination, this is not going to end well. And then I turn the car back, fighting it the whole way. 50 phone numbers of people in AA in my phone. No God. No connection to God. Belief that maybe there's a God out there, but not had one experience with it that could carry me through that experience. And and I drank. And I went on my last bender. It started in June of 2005, and 2,260 days ago, on August 21st of 2005, I had my last drink. My last drink was pretty scary. It was real scary because I don't just drink. I do a lot of really crazy stuff. And I had my second heart attack, and I died for 30 seconds, and they brought me back. And I wasn't planning on waking up from that one anyway. This was the first real one that was just like, yeah, this one will kill me, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. And I woke up anyway. And when I woke up in the hospital, I was really pissed off that I was there. And I looked up, and there was my dad sitting there, and he was looking at my feet, and I had really long toenails, and he looked at me looking at my feet, and he said, "You really need to cut your toenails, dude." And the doctor, you know, he came walking in, and he said, "You know, Andrew, you should be dead. You were dead for 30 seconds. We brought you back, you should probably stop doing what you're doing." And he walked out of the hospital room. And I went, fuck, I can't even die right, you know? I can't even kill myself right. This sucks. And they came in, and my dad's a psychiatrist, and his friend ran the psych ward at the county hospital there, and, you know, so he came over and met me, even though he was on vacation. My dad made a very big point to let me know that that's what was going on. And, you know, he came over, and he's like, "You know, we're going to voluntarily let you into this psych ward here, and if you come into this psych ward and then you decide to leave, you know, I will sign commitment papers to put you into the state hospital." And I just kind of said, okay. I mean, I didn't really care. I wasn't fighting it at all. I was tired. You know, that's a good place to be. My, you know, my great-grand sponsor, Don P., he used to speak a lot, and he passed away a few years ago. And one of the things he used to say is, if you're tired, you're in a good place for me to work with you. You know, as when I'm tired, just tired. Like, I just, you know, I don't have any fight left. I don't have any more ideas, you know. Like, maybe if I do it this way, or maybe if I get the right girlfriend, or any of that kind of stuff, or, you know, like, maybe I'm different. Maybe I'm a special and unique snowflake, you know? None of that stuff matters anymore. It's just, I'm just tired, you know? I'm just tired, and that's how I was. I was just tired, you know? I was tired. And so I said, whatever, man, put me in the psych ward. And I went into the psych ward, and I looked up on the wall in the Funny Farm room where we had, you know, little VHS tapes and stuff, and Katrina was happening. So again, my narcissistic mind is like, the world's coming to an end because I'm getting sober. And, watching this TV, and I look up, and you know, I'm on all these psych meds, and I see the steps and the traditions on the wall. And I said to myself, you know, Andrew, damn it, man, you've never given yourself 100% to anything other than getting loaded in your whole damn life. You know, I could give myself half-assed to going to meetings and talking about stuff and finding the girlfriend, you know, push past all the beautiful, wonderful, intelligent, recovered women for the psychopath in the back of the room. You know, I could do that all day. But actually commit myself to a recovery program and actually work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with everything I had? You know, I'd never done that. And so I made a choice right there. I said, you know what, I'm going to give everything I have to the 12 steps, and if it doesn't work, I can put a bullet in my head. And my friend had, I knew how I was going to shoot myself, I'll just say that. And I planned out my backup plan for when this didn't work. And I committed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to my weird little hospital bed. It's motorized, though. You know, I could, like, lean up and eat my tray. You know, I was on fall precautions because every time I stood up, I went and, like, hit the wall, you know. I had, like, all these colorful bracelets. Like, watch him if he's walking down the hall. And so I stumbled back into my room, 132 pounds, totally crazy, you know, hair, like, out. And I sat on the edge of my hospital bed and just said, whatever the fuck is good in listening. Excuse my language, but that's the prayer I said, and that's the prayer I used for the whole first few years of my sobriety. Whatever the fuck is good in listening, please help me. And I've been sober since that moment. 30 minutes later, I was taken for a wonderful STD test where they stick a long Q-tip in a fun place. It's not a fun thing to do when you're, like, sweating out all the booze, you know? Get that thing out of there, you know? And they're walking me back across to the, you know, the fun ward where the people actually wanted to be in the psych ward or something. I don't know. And I look up, and there's this guy that I knew from Alcoholics Anonymous. And see, this guy, he was the one that really 12-stepped me. And let me tell you how he 12-stepped me, right? I was getting coffee at a meeting once, and he walked up to me, and he said, are you a junkie? I said, what? I said, are you a junkie? I said, well, why? He said, you look like a fucking junkie. I said, okay. He said, it's all right, man. It takes one to know. And he walked away. So it's not the, you know, sitting me down and saying, oh, you know, here, you know, how much do you know about AA? It wasn't that. Because for whatever reason, that asshole caught my attention, and every time he shared a meeting, he made sense to me. That guy talked about drinking with tears in his eyes, not wanting to do it anymore. And I got that. You know what I mean? I got that. That last time I had gone out and picked up that bottle, I did not want to do it. I knew what was going to happen, and I couldn't help it. I had no other choice. For whatever reason, I heard that guy, and here he is at the damn hospital 30 minutes after I said that prayer with hospital scrubs on, and he goes, way to go! He goes for a high five. At which point, you know, I said...
Do you still go to meetings?
So yeah, you're still working with that same sponsor?
Well, no. I was kind of wondering if you might sponsor me.
He's like, well, good. Start calling me twice a day. Here's my phone number. Have a good night. Don't forget to take your meds. And walk back to the other side of the room. And I can't talk about him without talking about anonymity. Anonymity to me as a principle, you know, it goes beyond just, you know, not sharing my full name and stating I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in the public. It goes to what do I do when nobody's looking. I don't need personal prestige for what I do. I don't need to go like every time I, you know, oh, I helped this lady with her flat tire. I can't wait to go to the meeting and tell everybody how cool I am. 'Cause I'm so spiritual, you know. What do I do when nobody's looking? Well, this guy, I didn't know this until I had about a year sober. As soon as he went to the other side, he started calling people that he knew that had recovered from alcoholism. And he told them when the hospitals and institutions meeting was in the hospital I was at. And he said, there's this guy in here. I think you guys should all come to this meeting and come give him your phone number and let him know what he needs to do and where he can go. I didn't know that. All I knew was the next day he showed up at work and he said, why didn't you call? I said, dude, I'm still in the hospital, man. You work here. He said, I didn't tell you to start calling me twice a day when you got out. And I told you to start calling me twice a day. And I said, okay, I'll call you today. Want me to wait until you get to the other side? Ha ha ha. And he didn't smile at all. He just... No, what I want you to do is there's a meeting over here on this side at 7 o'clock. Go to the meeting, get some phone numbers. See you later. Don't forget to take your meds and walk to the other side. And I went to that meeting and there were like 15 people there that had recovered from alcoholism. And they shoved their phone numbers in my hand and they said, you know where to go when you get out, right? They told me I could come to you. I said, okay, I'll come be with you guys. What a long, strange trip it's been. That sponsor, when I got out of the hospital, told me to get a brand new big book, fourth edition, hardback, you know. And I was like, I got three of them. He's like, you got writing in them? I said, yep. He said, throw them away. I don't give a shit. You need a new big book. Get a 12 and 12, a dictionary, a pen, and a highlighter. Call me every day. I said, okay. I started calling him every day. He said, if you don't call me every day, we won't meet. He said, if you're 3 minutes late to my house, my door will be locked. First time I was 3 minutes late to his house, I was pissed off his door was locked and his phone was off. And that's the way I was sponsored through, you know, for the first year and a half of my sobriety. It was by a guy who held me to a standard that was beyond anything I had ever known. He taught me about discipline. He taught me about love. He taught me about doing what I say I'm going to do. And more importantly, he taught me about how to create a relationship with God through the process of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous by using the big book. And so I started meeting with him. And we got into the book. He had me turn to the first page. You know, the hardback's the only one with the first page. It's the blank one. He said, well, why don't you tell me what you know about keeping yourself clean and sober at the top of that page? You know, just write down what I know about keeping myself clean and sober. I said, okay, what I know about keeping myself clean and sober. You want me to write down the rest? He said, oh, no, why don't you just tell me real quick? I didn't realize the setup. I said, well, you know, my father's a psychiatrist, and I've been in therapy of some kind since I was like 7, you know. I've been to like 5 treatment centers, and I've been in and around AA for the last couple of years, and so probably, you know, what's worked and what hasn't worked, you know. And he said, we're going to stick with you don't know shit. Because whatever it is that you think you know about permanent recovery has led you here with shit. And so I said, oh, okay, I get it, you know. Then he had me turn to the next page, which says Alcoholics Anonymous on it, and he had me write at the top of that page where I can go to learn. And he had me turn to the title page, which says, this is the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Had me circle the word recovered and turn to page 85. Now, on page 85, it has our 10-step promises, right? He had me write recovered at the top of that page 85. And what it talks about in that is, you know, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. We'll seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. We will see that this has happened automatically. He said, Andrew, I promise you, if you take all of the actions from this point that we're at on the first page of the book to page 85, that this will be your experience. You can recover from alcoholism. I can't tell you what your life's going to look like or any of that kind of stuff. I will tell you that this will happen for you if you do this. Because it happened for me, I know it's true. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll say the same thing. If you do that stuff, it will happen for you, and I know that because it's my experience too. You know, I said, okay, man. I said, whatever, let's just do this thing. And we got into the first step. And the first step was important for me because, like I had said, I had believed I was an alcoholic, you know, and I had thought that I was an alcoholic kind of because I had, like, chosen to be an alcoholic and then, like, I don't know, something bad happened. or maybe I was cursed. I don't know. Maybe there was just something wrong with me, right? Like, maybe I'm just cursed and I'm damned. And what my sponsor did for me was that he shared his experience and he used the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to pull my experience from me. Right, he did that in a way where we took notes on different things, and he made me look up the definitions of all these damn words. He'd be like, "What does that word mean?" I'd be like, "Say, circle it, you know." All right, circle it. Now. That's why I have the dictionary. Okay, I get it. You know, like recovered. That's a really good one. You know, recover to regain something lost. There's a moment in my life where the obsession for alcohol did not exist, like before I ever drank. He told me that that could happen. Regain something lost. Interesting. You know, and we started to get into this stuff, and we talked about alcoholism, and alcoholism really started to make sense because, see, I could see in my experience how I had this physical abnormality around alcohol. Like, I really enjoyed drinking a lot. I mean, when it hit my chest and that burn happened and that stuff, you know, like, went over my body, I was transformed. I had a spiritual awakening every time I hit that point. You know, my ideas about life, everything, were rearranged completely. You know, and that's how it describes the spiritual awakening in the damn big book. You know, my ideas about life, God, the universe, everything changed just like that. You know, I had spiritual experiences as a result of drinking constantly. So I saw that because guess what? Normal people don't feel the same way. My mom, she drinks a little bit of wine and she goes, you know, I'm feeling it. I think I'm good. What? You're feeling it. You don't want to feel it? What the hell are you drinking wine for if you don't want to feel it? Get some damn sparkling apple cider or something, you know? What the hell is wrong with you? This stuff doesn't taste good. Is this fancy? You're just being fancy about it, Mom? I definitely did not drink wine to be fancy. I drank wine out of a box, you know? I'm drinking for the effect. So I could see the physical abnormality that I have around alcohol. And then when we got into the mental obsession, when it was described to me out of the big book that same way, right? Because I heard other people say the same crap at meetings. You know, when I start, I can't stop. When I stop, I just can't stop thinking about it all the time. And I was like, you know what, man? I obsess about myself a lot more than I obsess about alcohol, you know? I obsess about what I think you're thinking about me a lot more than I think about alcohol. But when I do think about drinking alcohol, I get drunk. Like, that's my problem, man. And everybody's experience is different, which is what's cool about the big book, right? Is it doesn't say this is the definition of what it looks like. It uses these different experiences, different people's experiences to describe that. My experience is, as I said with you, once the thought crowds into the mind, everything else is gone. And I get drunk, you know? And I saw that that was part of a disease that I had. And I saw this thing where it described, you know, when I'm without alcohol, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. That feeling, that void that I had, it started to make sense. I started to touch on this, and that doctor's opinion, you know, he said that just staying away from it wasn't enough. It seems that something more than human power was needed. And you know, Dr. Silkworth, man, he didn't write his name in the first edition of the big book. It wasn't in there. Because to say that as a doctor in the 30s, that, you know, we doctors, our human power is insufficient to help alcoholics. It seems to be that there needs to be some sort of spiritual intervention. That was occupational suicide. Of course, by the second edition of the big book, he was more than happy to put his name in there. Dr. William D. Silkworth. He doesn't need to be anonymous, you know. Come to my hospital. Right? But he alluded to that spiritual part of this illness as a doctor in the 30s, and it started to make sense. It started to make sense why I felt the way that I did. You know, and so I accepted and embraced that I was an alcoholic. And you know, that was enough to keep me going. But I also accepted that this person that I was sitting across from, that he was an alcoholic as well. And that because he had the same disease that I had, maybe I could have the same solution that he did. You know, Lindsay, she gave such a wonderful talk last night, man. I really enjoyed that. She talked in the second step, how she watches people that, you know, they're just upset in their second step because God's not their bestie yet. You know, we need to be besties. Or I need to believe in God even is really, you know, do you really need to believe in God at the second step? Is that what it's about? You know, for me, the second step was about coming to believe that maybe there is a God. Maybe there's a power greater than myself, but more importantly, maybe I can gain access to this power through the 12 steps. And I got that because I saw that this man across from me had. I knew that he believed that. Maybe if I did the steps, I could have an experience with this God, whatever it may be. And so the third step was just making a decision that I was going to do everything I could to do that. And I looked at my sponsor and I heard all the little stuff that people said. You know, the third step, I need to have this blinding white light experience because now I have embraced God as my creator and I'm just going to walk off hand in hand to the spirit of the universe with him. And I was like, I don't feel like I want to walk anywhere, you know. I just kind of want to stay here and get sober. What the hell do I need to do? You know, and he's like, make a decision to do the rest of the damn work. So you'll know you've done a good third step if you do 4 through 9. I said, okay. I choose now that I'm going to do this. I'm going to give everything I have to it. And, you know, so I got into the inventory. The fourth step for me was about illuminating these twists of character that I didn't realize were below the reservoir of my consciousness. And I did so by analyzing my resentments and seeing that, you know, my part is I resolutely looked at my mistakes. What mistakes have I made in this? Because you can't tell somebody that, you know, everybody comes in and if they had like some childhood trauma or something that, you know, they were really like attacked by someone, they say, what's my part in that? You know, and it's like, okay, maybe you didn't have a part, right? The thing that I'm supposed to look at is my mistakes and how I handle the situation, whether that was at the time or after that. And a lot of times, mistakes that I've made is holding on to shit just because it makes me feel a little bit better about what's going on with me. It's a lot easier to be angry at you than it is to look in the mirror and feel all the feelings that I felt about myself when I got sober. Because I'd done a lot of really bad stuff, and I felt a lot of even worse things about myself. And what happened is I exposed the lie. Because underneath all that stuff, the reason I reacted that way is the lie. It's the spiritual illness as I have experienced it. And this void in my heart that tells me that me, naked, alone with God, is never going to be good enough. And you know, that's a human spiritual problem. It's not just alcoholics that feel that way. My problem is that after a while, I treated that feeling with alcohol until I crossed a line with alcohol I couldn't come back from. And so the inventory helped me expose that, and it exposed the truth that, you know what, I'm just a human being. And human beings have human instincts for sex, for security, and for society. As my sponsor loves to say, every morning he wakes up, you know, he wants a piece of pie, he wants to get laid, and he wants somebody to pat him on the back and tell him he's special. And in my strivings for these things, when you add that twist and that spiritual illness that tells me that I'm not good enough, I have to lie, cheat, and steal in order to get enough of those things to be okay. And of course, I need a lot more of them than I really deserve in order to be okay. And then it just gets really messed up. That's what I found in my inventory. And then, you know, with all this stuff, these things I didn't want to tell anybody, the first resentment on my inventory was about how this girl had potentially exposed me to, bless you, to hepatitis C. And I was sober, and I was in relationships with people, and I wasn't telling them about it. And so I wrote it a certain way so that maybe I could say it without saying the whole truth. You know, like say, oh, she gave me this disease that I have for the rest of my life, you know, because I also started getting loaded with her, you know. And, so maybe I could just say, she gave me alcoholism. You know? And what happened instead was I sat down with my sponsor the very first time, and I told him that one. I just sat down and I said it, and I cried and I let it all out, and the most miraculous thing happened. This guy not only didn't judge me for it, he loved me more for telling him the truth. I could feel it. I could feel that he knew there was something happening. He said, Andrew, I'm really proud of you. I really feel like you're taking this thing seriously. And he gave me a hug. That guy wasn't big on compliments, you know. He just gave me a big hug. And I looked, and when I was saying it, he was crying. I was like, oh my God, I made you cry too. I made my sponsor cry. And so the fifth step for me was so illuminating because I got to see that this other guy had actually thought, felt, and done a lot of the same things. Not all the same way, but very similar. And that got to show me that we were all human beings and we all have these sicknesses and we all have these twists of character and that we can all forgive ourselves for those. We don't have to beat ourselves up for it. Step six for me was that now I had this list of these things. Like, you know, I could see where I really sucked at trusting people. And when I looked at these character defects and I got to ask myself, am I really ready to let go of that? Letting go of not trusting anybody does not mean you go and start trusting everybody. It's a really bad idea. What it did mean for me is that what's a lot more important is that I worry about being trustworthy. And so step six and seven, I got to actually look at what are the opposites of all of these character defects that I have. Maybe I should worry about being trustworthy. Maybe I should worry about living with humility. Maybe I should be honest. And I got to ask myself, am I really willing to grow toward this? And I also got to see that there were some of those things I already did pretty well. So my inventory wasn't just about looking at all my part and how much I sucked. I got to use that also to illuminate some of my assets, you know, and to figure out what I got to grow toward and create an ideal. Steps 8 and 9 for me was where I got to start actually trying to live up toward that ideal. Step 8, I made this list of all the people that I had harmed, and I wrote amend letters to them. My amend letters go like this. I got a prayer on the top of the page that says, you know, thank you, God, for keeping me open, honest, and willing. Thank you for the words. It says, dear whoever, I owe you an amend. Today I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and part of the program of recovery for freedom from alcohol is restitution for harm done. I was wrong for having harmed you by. And in a general way, I got to illuminate some of those character defects. And the reason I say in a general way, you know, I thought I needed to be really specific about that. And what I learned from my sponsor that really helped me was that they know the harm I've caused them a hell of a lot better than I ever can. And so the most important thing is that I share that I know that I did this. You know, I was a very selfish and inconsiderate son. And I just want you to know that I feel bad about it. Not say I'm sorry. I just want you to know that I really feel bad about it. And in order for me to fully understand it, is there anything that you'd like to say about how my behavior has affected you? You know. And at the end it says, you know, is there anything else I can do to make this right? God bless you. I love you, Andrew. And I got to approach people and do that. And the most incredible thing happened when I did that, for instance, with my mother, is I sat across from her and I said, you know, after she said, she cut me off in the middle of it, and she was like, well, what do you remember? Because, you know, remember I said black belt codependent, you know, she's good, man, she had lists, you know, and she cut me off and she started saying that stuff, and this, you know, I started feeling this feeling like, you know what? it hurts to hear how much I hurt my mother, but what's a lot cooler is that I know that I'm not the same person anymore. And when she was done, I said that. I said, Mom, I just want you to know I love you so much, and I feel really bad about all that stuff. And, you know, God willing, I'll never be that person again, but most importantly, the man that sits before you today is a different person. And I knew that I meant it. I knew I was telling the truth. And I looked and I realized that I'd recovered. And I was at the 10th step, page 85. You know, I had ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, and sanity had returned. You know, it says in the 10th step in the big book that we have just now made conscious contact with our Creator, so we have to continue to watch for the return of alcoholism. Watch for fear and doubt, man. When that stuff is there, alcoholism's right behind that door, you know, and my thinking patterns get really messed up. And I have to remember, I'm human, and it's okay for me to be human and make mistakes, but when I start making decisions based on fear and irrational stuff, bad stuff happens, and it just spirals out of control. And so I have to watch for it. And the 10th step for me comes in many different ways. I go on retreats. I love going on retreats with a bunch of guys and 100 dudes sit there and pray together and cry and do all kinds of stuff. It's just wonderful. You know, tough guy, gone. Now I like to cry with a bunch of dudes. You know, but it comes in that form. But one of the most important forms for me is I have a few people in my life that know absolutely everything. Everything that I think, everything I feel, everything I do, even the nasty stuff I don't want to tell anybody about, I tell them that. You know, I ask myself, is this something I really should tell somebody? And I know if, when in doubt, tell somebody about it. You know, and I do that. I do that constantly. One, you know, there's a couple people in this room that really know what's going on in my life, and I can trust them completely. You know, and the 11th step for me is then, having just made this conscious contact with God, I have to continue to try to improve that relationship through prayer and meditation, seeking to understand what His will is for me. You know, and prayer and meditation is an important part of my process. I'd like to say that all the time I meditate every day, I'll go for, I went for probably a good year and a half where I meditated every day, like actual sitting down, like mindful breathing meditations. But I don't do that every day. What I do is I try to be conscious and aware of where I am and what's going on with me and what the perceptions are that's coming up. And I get real about that stuff, you know, and I give myself that space to just breathe and kind of feel the presence of God every day. And for me, that's a practice of meditation. It doesn't have to look like sitting down and lighting candles and burning incense and ringing chimes and stuff, which I love to do. singing bowls and all kinds of stuff. My house is just so much fun. You just come out, you'll love it. What happens with that is I continue to stay on this journey, right? Like I continue to grow toward God. I grow toward God, and as I grow toward Him, He comes back toward me, and together we connect with this power that I get to use to help you. And then we come to the 12th step. My spirit has woken up. I'm spiritually awake. That's what happened when I did the steps. I spiritually woke up, and because of that, I can see the truth. And the truth is that every single one of you in this room is a loving child of God. And God wants us all to be happy, joyous, and free. And I know that. And for me to practice these principles in all of my affairs means that I need to offer that unconditional love to you. When I heard that somebody stole, you know, we heard somebody may have stolen a cooler out of the thing. You know, I would love to think that no person on a path of recovery would do that. I hope it was just somebody else in a hotel, you know. But what I do think, you know, about people that are in recovery and the kind of man that I want to be is I see these little cards in the hotel and they say, you know, I took some care to help out your room. If you liked it, you know, drop this card off. Wouldn't it be nice if every single one of us, in practicing these principles in all of our affairs, took those cards and wrote something nice on it, walked up to one of the staff at the hotel and said, thank you for what you do. Your smile lights up the room. You know? What if we all went up to like 5-10 different people that we didn't know tonight and went to the little fuzzy things or whatever you guys are trading out? But we just went up to each other and we just gave each other a hug and said some nice compliment, right? Not just the same, hi, how are you, where are you from stuff, but just, you know, really focused on what's something nice about this person that I can say. What if we all did that tonight? Wouldn't it make it a better world?
Yeah.
Imagine we did that every day. I hope we can all take that gift with us. That's all I have tonight.